Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones.
So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
So today's guest is Stuart Wade. Stuart was a successful athlete specialising in martial arts and won 20 British Open and UK titles, as well as 3 European championships and 4 world championships in taekwondo and kickboxing. And in 2014, he was inducted into the Martial Arts Illustrated magazine UK Martial Arts Hall of Fame. Now Stuart works as a clinical hypnotherapist and licensed neurolinguistic programming practitioner, a personal trainer and level 4 strength and conditioning coach. I'm really delighted to have you along with us to have a conversation today, Stuart. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Hello, Stuart. Very nice to meet you. And that's a fantastic record that you've got. Congratulations for all of that. Could we begin with you telling us a bit about hypnotherapy? Because I guess some people have some ideas about hypnotherapy, but I bet they're mostly not very accurate.
Yes, there's a few misconceptions about there. Typically that it's going to take control of your mind and make you dance around like a chicken or, you know, you name it, any number of weird and wonderful things. And that is a real side of the stage hypnosis aspect of things, which is not what I do. Now, hypnotherapy is typically a form of one-to-one therapy in which someone can be taken from a negative state, whatever that might be, and genuinely it can help psychological, emotional, and even physical issues. So whatever the ailment is presenting as, we can help sometimes alleviate that and get rid of it completely. Sometimes it's reducing the symptoms to help them live a happier and healthier life. It really depends on what the issue is and how open to the procedure the client is as well, because they have to be on board to an extent, certainly. I always say to my clients, be open to the possibility of this helping you. If you go in with a closed mind, you're going to be hard-pressed to make the difference that you want to make. But at the same time, I always tell people not to just blindly believe everything that I say. You know, feel free to ask questions and really understand it for themselves as well.
Thank you. So what does a typical hypnotherapy session look like?
Mm-hmm. So my process is that I do a full 90-minute consultation first with my clients, and that is very much a partnership where I'm talking as much as they are. Sometimes they talk more than me. I want to get to the root of what the problem is. After we've done all of that and I go away and formulate what I'm going to do with them in terms of a treatment schedule, the next time I see them, typically they'll either be seated or lying down, whichever they feel more comfortable with. And for the most part, they'll have their eyes closed and I will be talking to their subconscious mind, helping to rewire the brain, essentially. So they're talking, generally speaking, is very minimal when they're actually in a formal hypnosis session. I usually just ask for an acknowledgement that they've understood now and again, which is very minimal, usually a nod of the head or an audible yes. I don't tend to get them to give me a big monologue or anything during hypnosis.
Thank you. So you've hinted at this already, but can anyone be hypnotized?
I believe so. There's differing schools of thought on it. I believe that everybody can be hypnotized, but it's a bit of a spectrum. Some people who are what you might term somnambulists, who I could almost walk up to in the street. If I knew that person was this way inclined, I could almost walk up to them and say, sleep, and they would. Those people are very few and far between. There are some out there, but not so many. I think most people fall somewhere in the kind of middle of the spectrum to where they can be hypnotized, provided they are open to the process. I think there are some people who are going to be more difficult to hypnotize, but I don't think it's impossible for anybody, really. I think it's definitely something that can be achieved by everyone. It just depends on the levels of susceptibility and how open they are to it.
Yeah. So, Stuart, you've made it very clear that you don't do a stage act, yet I understand that you were introduced to hypnotism by Paul McKenna. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's right, David, I was. So, let me get this right. I believe it was the beginning of 2013. I had just been going through a bit of a rough time, so I wasn't in the best headspace myself at this point. And I was reading the Sunday Mirror newspaper, and there was a 2-page article in the middle of the newspaper about Paul McKenna's new book. And this book was about a technique called havening, which I'd never heard of. But I had a read and found the article very fascinating, thought it was really interesting about the technique. And down the right-hand side of the page, there was a little column where they were advertising a competition. And the parameters were that Paul was going to pick 3 people from anywhere in the UK to go to his house in, I believe it was in Mayfair at the time, central London. And he was going to do the havening technique with the winners there and then, and hopefully sort out whatever issue was afflicting them. And so because of my state of mind at the time, I thought, well, what the heck, I'm going to enter and see what happens. I had no real thought to the fact that I might be selected, but I was. And so I went down, met Paul, and he and I got along very well straight off the bat, really, because unbeknownst to me, he had a very big admiration for Bruce Lee, just like I do, and did at the time as well. And so we got off to a really good start on that to begin with. And then we went into the actual havening technique itself. And so, yeah, it was quite an experience being treated by Paul McKenna at his house.
Indeed, indeed. I have to confess, I've never been to a house in Mayfair.
I haven't been to one since, so yeah.
What is the havening technique?
So the havening technique, and I must stress that I'm not qualified in this technique, but from my recollections of the procedure and having looked at it over the years, it combines bits of hypnotic suggestion, some bits of EMDR, so eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing, and some visualization elements, and also physical touch. And I'll clarify that very quickly so nobody gets the wrong idea. The therapist would touch, if you can see this on the video, touch and stroke the palms of the hands and also the outside of the arms here, because the studies that were done on developing the technique apparently showed that sort of touch on those areas of the body would stimulate serotonin production. And the idea is that by doing the procedure of the havening technique, you are desensitizing the reactions in the amygdala from whatever traumatic or painful memories or events that you've experienced in your life. And so, speaking from personal experience of having had it done, it worked tremendously well for me. It was the imagery that was the big thing for me. That was the most profound aspect to it that I felt a change in, where the images that I had in my mind prior to the treatment were very, very clear. They were very large, you know, filling up my entire field of view. It was very real. And after the technique, those same images were very blurry, very small, and they were literally grayscale. They were just black and white, where before they were, you know, 4K, high definition, full color, the whole thing. And so, and obviously with that, the feelings that I had that accompanied those images were significantly diminished as well. So it's a very interesting technique. It kind of pulls together various different therapeutic approaches. And as I say, I'm not trained in it, but it seemed to do the trick for what I was experiencing at the time.
Well, you're speaking really positively about it. I suppose I'm curious about why you haven't trained in it. What's stopped you?
To be frank, the cost. It's expensive. It's expensive to train in it. That's the only reason.
Good enough reason.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very interesting, and I'll add on to the back of that actually as well. When I had finished the day with Paul, that was the light bulb moment for me in terms of wanting to learn more about this whole industry and get into it. And I actually asked him there and then, I want to study this stuff. I want to get qualified in it. What should I do? And he didn't tell me to go and study the Havening technique right away. He said you should go and study the NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming practitioner course with Dr. Richard Bandler, because he was Paul's mentor. So he said, he taught me everything I know. That's where you should start. And so that's what I did. And then from that, then I moved into hypnotherapy, and the rest, as they say, is history.
What's the relationship between NLP and hypnotherapy?
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Richard Bandler and I don't know if he was actually a doctor, the other guy, Simon Grinder, who were the co-founders of NLP, they developed NLP as a discipline from the work of Milton Erickson, who was a hypnotherapist or hypnotist, depending on your terminology, in the 50s. And they developed it from his work. And it's all about language patterns and how to use language to overcome issues in behavior, in thoughts, in feelings. The traditional NLP framework didn't really involve hypnosis too much. It was very much about the language used and the communication of that, between that of the client and the therapist. The newer form of NLP, I say newer form, the kind of developments that the field has had over the years, involves a bit more what I would call hypnosis and trance work. But the relationship is that NLP was kind of derived from hypnosis, really. And there is a lot of overlap with them in terms of they both use language to elicit certain thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, just sometimes in a different approach, not necessarily eyes closed in trance. Sometimes it's more conversational with NLP. Yeah, there's a lot of crossover.
Thank you. Yeah, NLP seems to have had a bit of a bad press, I think partly because it was adopted en masse by sales people.
Yes.
And this sense of people being manipulated into buying stuff that maybe they didn't really want. But certainly I've seen NLP used to help people be calmed down when they, you know, come out of a flashback in sessions. And, you know, that's really impressive to see how powerful that can be. And I suppose, you know, part of any therapeutic modality is to try and get alongside the patient, the client, and mirroring being part of that. And really, you know, NLP's not so far removed from that, is it, in the sense of trying to find ways in to be accessible to people.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was particularly the mirroring and matching aspects of rapport building that I learned on that first NLP qualification that I did, that I actually really adopted that in my work as much as anything in terms of getting that rapport going with a prospective client. That was something that really stood out to me, and it's always helped so much. And if you can, obviously, if the client trusts you and you've got that rapport there, chances are you're going to get a good therapeutic outcome.
Thank you. I mean, it is January and it is the time of New Year's resolutions, and quite a lot of people turn to hypnotherapy to help them quit smoking or overeating, don't they? Is that something you offer as part of your practice? And how does hypnotherapy work for people when they're trying to increase their willpower or desist from behaviours that they don't want to engage in?
Mm-hmm. So I do offer help with weight loss, particularly. I do smoking cessation as well, although I've not done too much of it over the years, in all honesty. It's quite the antithesis, really, to what you think of with hypnotherapy. People go to stop smoking, but I haven't really experienced that. I've worked with a few clients for that, but it's not really been something I've attracted. And with hypnotherapy itself, whatever the issue is that someone is coming to the practice presenting, whatever their issue is that they want to overcome, we want to delve into the deep root causes of that straight off the bat and unpack what we can and see if there's any secondary gain going on, if they're getting some kind of benefit from that thing that they say they want to stop or move past. So we really want to get deep in there so I can understand fully what's going on. And then when they're actually in hypnosis itself, we then can address some of this stuff subconsciously and literally rewire their brain. When they're in that relaxed theta brainwave state, that's where the magic happens for me. That's where their critical faculties have been put to one side, and where I can start then to give them suggestions and instructions when they're in that hypnotic state to fire and wire different neural pathways in the brain to get them to start thinking in a different way, feeling in a different way. And then using visualizations and other tools like that, we can start then to get them behaving in a different way as well. So it can help, as you said there, Naomi, with willpower. It's getting that initial belief and building the confidence in that person that they can actually do this thing. You know, if in all honesty, I work with confidence with every client. Whatever the issue is, they're going to benefit better if they've got more confidence. They're going to get more results if they believe that they can do it. And so boosting the confidence subconsciously without that psychological resistance of the conscious mind is a key aspect to the work that I do, before getting into some of the other nitty-gritty stuff that's more specific to their issue. If that makes sense.
Because I was wondering, as you were talking as well, about whether you're helping people re-sculpt their identity as well. You know, if you've been a smoker, for instance, that you're building an identity as a non-smoker, you know, if somebody who doesn't need that, rather than just focusing on the deficit. But I suppose increasingly we see what the power of sort of thinking about what you want to be can be useful, a useful part of the therapeutic process, not just what you're trying to move away from.
Mm. That's right. And it's, I like that you brought that up about identity there as well, because I actually spoke about this on another podcast recently, but I was once taught a procedure, and I hadn't heard the words that he used before, but it made a lot of sense the way he conveyed it. He was talking about removing something from somebody's mind. So in this case, we'll use the smoking example. So if I'm trying to move this person to be a non-smoker, and that's, let's say, a part of their identity, I'm almost taking something away from them. And we don't want them to have a kind of hole inside them, whether that's in their identity or some other aspect of themselves. And so after we've removed something negative, we want to backfill, and that was his wording, backfill something positive in its place. And that is tip with me anyway, that's typically ironed out and clarified in the consultation I do at the beginning. So I know what they want to be, who they feel they are as a person outside of that thing. And so that's where I can start to then install some of the positive frameworks for who they're going to be going forwards, rather than holding on to that identity as a smoker, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just making me think of, you know, other forms of therapy. Like there's a form of therapy called schema-focused therapy, where there's a lot of attention given to, you know, limiting beliefs that you hold about yourself and your relationship mm-hmm. to the world. And when the therapeutic modality first developed, there's a lot of attention, you know, would be given in therapy to addressing, trying to undermine that belief. But obviously over time, people come to appreciate how important it is to be replacing that with a positive schema about who you are and your relationship to the world. But you know, smoking and overeating obviously are really important issues. Both of them have massive health consequences. But are there any other more clinical applications where it works really well for sort of more mental health type issues, not just the behavioural problems?
Mm-hmm. So fears and phobias is a big one with hypnosis. And it's as well as the fears and phobias and other psychological things, even physical issues can be really helped along by hypnosis. And that was something that I had to get my head around it early on as well, because I had a couple of clients in particular who were presenting with physical issues. And early on, I wasn't very experienced. I was still pretty green. And my thought process was, I think this can help, but I don't know for a fact. Obviously, I didn't communicate to them the extent of my, how unsure I was about it, but let's do it and let's try and help. And one client, for example, was suffering with narcolepsy. And, you know, I'd never come across that before in a hypnosis setting or in any other setting. I'd heard about it, but I'd never encountered anybody with this thing, and no cure for it, no treatment. So I was very unsure as to how well this would work, but she wanted to give it a go because she was sort of at the end of her rope, essentially, with it. And what I also didn't know going in was that the actual sleep of someone with narcolepsy, on, you know, nightly sleep, is massively affected. And so she would maybe get an hour's sleep a night, something like that, if she was lucky. And obviously that was in very small increments. Whenever her trigger would be triggered during the day, she would just go. She would just collapse like that. And could be an hour or more before she would come back to consciousness then. And after our first session, she messaged me the next day, and she actually said, "Oh my God, what have you done to me? I slept 8 hours last night straight through, real deep, restful sleep." And so even something like narcolepsy that's a bit of a niche issue and something with no real treatment or cure in Western medicine, hypnosis, by tapping into the nervous system, by tapping into the subconscious mind in the right way, can help to improve the symptoms of something like that. But in terms of other clinical applications, depression can be a big one with hypnosis as well. That's something that might take a little bit longer. Some of the clients that I've worked with in the past who had clinical depression, it's almost starting off from a regression not in terms of going back in the mind to the past, but we can't really be thinking about how they want to be. The initial part is what would be normal, what would be okay. You know, we're not thinking about the grand dreams and that kind of thing with someone who's clinically depressed. We have to start off a little bit closer to home with that. So, but genuinely, you name it, and hypnosis can help, at least with any issue, at least in my experience. I haven't come across anything that it hasn't at least helped the person to cope with that thing a bit better, if not help to alleviate it.
I was reading Bruce Lipton's The Biology of Belief recently, and he talks a lot about people healing from like really serious physical health problems, like including cancer, using the power of the mind. And he comes from a medical background and was very much immersed in sort of biology before having to accept that these sorts of things, kind of like quite miraculous things, can happen when the mind's engaged to support the body. Sorry, David, you look like you're just...
I was going to ask Stuart, how do you know what's doing the work? So if you're working with someone who's depressed and you work with them over quite an extended period of time, and as you've already described, really, a lot, particularly at the beginning, you said, but I imagine ongoing, a lot of it is to do with you forming a relationship with them and understanding the issues that they're bringing along to you and then talking about them. So how do you know that it's the hypnotherapy doing the work rather than the relationship building, which in some ways, of course, replicates or is just like everyday psychotherapy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. And I think I would be ignorant to say that it's definitely the hypnotherapy that's working. It very much depends on the client. That's something that I've come to notice as well. With some clients often report that they feel a little bit better after the consultation with me, where we're just talking and I'm unpacking what their issue is. So that very much starts the process. But all the theory and everything that I was taught about hypnotherapy and my work with all the clients I've worked with over the years would tell me that the hypnotherapy is working. But if it is actually the support, and maybe not even necessarily the therapy, just having someone in their corner to help them along and metaphorically hold their hand through this process of being depressed, then my thought on it really is, as long as it's working, whether it's the hypnotherapy or that, it doesn't really matter. And it very much depends on the person. Some people aren't really bothered about having their hand held in that way. They just want to be out for the count with their eyes closed, drifting off into that state of hypnosis. But some people want a lot more engagement and a lot more conversation back and forth. So, yeah, it very much depends on the person. It's a good question, David. And just circling back to what you said before, Naomi, I really like Bruce Lipton and Dr. Joe Dispenza as well. I've got a number of their books, and I actually attended a seminar that Dr. Joe Dispenza ran in London a couple of years ago, and it's fascinating work. It really is. And it certainly makes me question even more how powerful our minds are and what else we could tap into subconsciously or in the quantum realm, as Dr. Joe Dispenza talks about.
Thank you. Now, Stuart, we see all those trophies behind, and you've clearly got very impressive background in sport. I'm assuming that quite a lot of people you work with come to you from the sports sector. And if they do, what kind of work are you doing with sports people?
So typically with sports people, they want to win more. That's the goal. And in all honesty, though, there's very few of them that actually haven't got any other issues, at least not that they're telling me. And it's just that they want to perform better. They're looking for that little edge that's going to get them the first place trophy or the belt or whatever it is. I have one client like that at the moment. He's just, his mission is to be the best MMA fighter that he can be. And he's got no issues holding him back. It's just that he wants to perform as best he can. And so that is what we're focusing on. But that being said, a number of athletes as well do have issues that need addressing. And so that is the first port of call. And sometimes just dealing with that issue is going to help them to perform better. Sometimes it might be, right, we need to deal with this first, sort this issue out first, and then we focus on improving your performance and getting you more wins. Sometimes the two are related, sometimes they're not, but it's all about winning more and performance with the sports people typically.
Thank you. And how has your own background in sport shaped your role as a hypnotherapist in terms of, you know, there's probably differences in how you go about it as opposed to someone who's come from a different background?
Mm. Well, with hindsight, looking back, I can see how my path through my life in sport and then academically and whatnot led me to doing this. But at the time, I didn't have a grand plan to get into it. But when I was sort of 16, 17 years old, and I was competing, I was competing internationally by this point. So I was competing at a high level, representing England and Great Britain semi-regularly. And I don't remember where I picked it up from, but I started implementing a visualization practice into my warm-ups when I was at the arena. And I'd go somewhere quiet and I'd do my stretches and get my body warmed up. But then I'd also either sit down or take a knee and just close my eyes and just visualize what I wanted to do out there. And the result didn't always go my way, but in terms of my preparation and how I was feeling in myself, it always just helped to get me into the zone and just get me into the best possible state to go out there and perform as best I could at the time. And so having that experience myself and having a lot of success in what I did in martial arts, it almost makes it even more congruent for me to talk about it then with other athletes, because I've been there and done that. And I, even before I was qualified, I was using some of these techniques and tools to help me get the results that I did. It helps with that buy-in, because as you said earlier, there's still a little bit of stigma about hypnosis out there. It's a little bit woo, it's a little bit weird, but if you've been there and done that, it just helps your credibility a little bit more. So, and that, I've certainly found that with me.
What are some of those myths about hypnotherapy that you have to overcome with clients?
So the first one is what we touched on earlier, that you're going to be dancing around like Elvis on a stage, or clucking like a chicken, or eating an onion and thinking it's an apple, whatever it might be. And if you're going for stage hypnotism, that's what you expect. But this is the complete opposite setting of that. It's private. There's not an audience to make laugh. It's completely confidential between myself and the client, unless obviously extenuating circumstances of harm, etc. And the other big myth is that I'm going to brainwash my client and I'm going to take control of their mind and they can't do anything about it, which is completely false as well. It's very much a cooperation between the two of us. My mentor told me, and he used this analogy when he was describing it, and I really like it. It makes a lot of sense. as the therapist, I'm the sat nav. The client is the one driving the car. So I'm just guiding them through the experience, but they're the one in control. And they can stop it at any time if they want to. I can't make them do anything that they don't want to do. It's very much a partnership in that way. And I'm trying to think of some of the other big myths of it. I don't own a pocket watch. That's one, so there's not going to be a pocket watch swinging about, you know. Those tend to be the main things, the brainwashing and the stage stuff. But once we get past those, then it seems to flow a little bit more naturally.
So anyway, putting sport aside, Stuart, are there any techniques or ideas from hypnotherapy that people could harness to improve their own well-being?
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of techniques. And one of the things that I tend to say in situations like this is a little technique called color breathing. And it's very simple to do. And the procedure that I offer to people with this is take a couple of minutes when you don't need to be doing anything, when you're not driving or operating heavy machinery, or nobody needs anything, wants anything, go somewhere quiet, close your eyes, and just slow your breathing down. And it doesn't even have to be a breathing pattern that's a specific protocol. We don't need to do a physiological sigh or box breathing or anything else. Just breathe in a way that's comfortable and slow it down for 5 breaths. And then, using your imagination, think about a color that represents anything negative. And as we've said before, that can be something that's just on your mind that's bothering you or causing you stress or anxiety. It could be an emotional issue. It could even be a physical issue. Think about a color that represents whatever that negative thing is, and just visualize in your mind breathing that color out when you exhale. And I always use the imagery of that being on a cold winter's day, and you can see your breath going out. That's how I see it when I do this technique, but it's tinged with that color. Do that for 5 breaths as well, and then think about a positive color. So something that you want to be feeling more of at that time, whether it's just happy, healthy, confident, pain-free, whatever it is. Think of a positive color and then imagine inhaling that for 5 breaths. And then put the two together. Breathe out the negative color, inhale the positive color. And you could do that for literally 2 minutes, and I would almost guarantee that you feel better after those 2 minutes than you did when you started. Something as simple as that can really help to put you into a better state. It depends how much time you've got to dedicate to it and how much self-awareness as well, because you can start to think about the thoughts that are popping in and out of your head and the language that you're using when you're talking in general, but then also your self-talk. So there's lots of different avenues you could go down with it. And it almost depends as well on the type of person that you are. If you're a more visual biased person and you could really see a positive image in your mind, tap into that. If you're more of an auditory person, think about the sounds, the positive sounds that you can hear, attune into those. If you're a kinesthetic person, the feelings, either emotions or physical feelings in the body, can tap into those. There's almost a plethora of different techniques and approaches you could use depending on what type of person you are. But I always find that the color breathing one that I went to there, most people can engage with that pretty easily, and it tends to work pretty well for the majority of people.
It sounds great. That's really good advice there, Stuart. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure. No problem.
So finally, I was going to leave that one for you, but so finally, Stuart, I imagine that physical movement is important to you in terms of your well-being. And obviously you've just shared there the colour breathing. Is there any other advice you'd share with listeners to help them improve their own well-being?
So for me, it needs to be a holistic approach, because we are in physical bodies, and so we have to address certain things that support our biology as well. So we're designed to move. We wouldn't have a muscular system if we weren't. So if you can just do some form of activity to move your body a little bit each day, that will help you to feel better within whatever limitations you may have. I'll caveat that with. And it could be walking, it could be dancing, it could be going to the gym, whatever floats your boat. And then trying to eat a little bit more healthily as well. And initially, if you're not somebody who's very, very up on their diet and what they should and shouldn't be eating, don't worry about eliminating anything. Try and incorporate some more fruit and vegetables, another serving of fruit or vegetables each day, just to begin with. Just get the ball rolling in that direction, because you are what you eat, as they say. And if you're fueling yourself, well, you're not really fueling yourself if you're eating junk food all the time. So if you're eating the correct foods, you're going to get more nutrients to the brain and the body, and that's going to help you to feel better as well. And then, as we've talked about with the mindset, being on top of the thoughts that you think and the things that you tell yourself about yourself as well. It's so important that you're aware of these things and you can make some modifications to make it a little bit more positive. And by just taking these little steps in that right direction with moving your body, eating right, thinking better thoughts, you're setting yourself on the path then to feel better in all ways, essentially, mentally, physically, emotionally. It's going to help, certainly.
Thank you. And especially, yeah, thank you for highlighting the importance of the self-talk there. I think people often talk to themselves in ways that they would consider to be totally unacceptable to talk to other people in that way. And yet they'll use, yeah, you know, really negative, derogatory phrases towards themselves. And obviously, if that's what you're drip feeding your brain, it's not going to be very conducive to good emotional well-being, is it? Thank you very much for that conversation, Stuart. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me, both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Great to meet you, Stuart, and thanks very much indeed for those valuable tips.
You too, David. Thank you.
Lovely.